Welcome to the Women in Public Policy Program Seminar Series podcast at the Harvard Kennedy School.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get started. I know there are a few people still in the hallway trying to get lunch, but I'm really excited about it. So welcome back. Happy New Year. My name is Hannah Riley Bowles. I'm a research director here at the Women in Public Policy Program, which gives me the opportunity to host this seminar. So here at WAP, we are committed to closing gender gaps in the areas of economic opportunity, political participation, health, and education. Very excited to introduce our speaker today. Sally Nyuma, is that right? Did you say it that way, or I should have checked that with you?
No worries. It's Nyuma.
Nyuma. Nyema. Excellent. It's more beautiful. Yeah. So Sally Nyema is actually going to be, she's going to be an assistant professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy starting in the fall. She is really an extraordinary background. She is, I think what we're going to hear about today is some of your dissertation research. Is that correct or no?
No.
Okay. Wrong then. But, I'm going to stick to my notes. All right. Sally is a WAP fellow and a values and public policy fellow at Princeton University. She does work at the intersection of gender, race, and education politics. And I can veer a little bit right now, but one of the very important insights that she's providing is also in the relationship between education and citizenship. So she not only is doing research in this area, but she's also doing some policy work with a number of different countries looking at the intersections of how policies affect disadvantaged groups with a special emphasis on girls, and then also the intersection of education with one's capacity to participate. She was recently named or selected a White House nominated change maker and awarded by Chicago Scholars as one of the 35 under 35 leaders making an impact. So, unfortunately, I can't stop there because she has a documentary, actually, believe it or not, on girls and education in Ghana called Her Story, which was recently awarded the Best Educational Documentary from PBS Top 25 International Film Festival and is currently being distributed by Discovery Education. So she graduated from George Washington University in 2011, is now a trustee of George Washington, and I'm just going to step back because we're just dying to hear from this woman. So please join me.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
So I'm really excited to be here to share this work, and thank you for being here. I know there were a lot of other events on campus today. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about kind of where I come from, because it really shapes my research. I was born and raised in the inner city of Chicago, but of parents that immigrated from Ghana. And this really plays an important role in what I've decided to do research on. I started working with girls in Ghana in 2009, and my dissertation is a departure from that. It actually focuses on the educational impacts of health policies on disadvantaged populations in the U.S. And all of this is really tied together by this belief that whether you're in urban Accra or urban Chicago, the debilitating effects of poverty have similar impacts on the ability for young people to pursue life success. And the idea that there's probably nothing more probable for improving the life chances of disadvantaged kids than public education. And so that's really what ties us together for me. This particular presentation is different than my PhD in political science. It's actually a focused investigation of one school's effort to try to improve the educational achievement of its girl learners. And through a focus on this case in Ghana, I'm really interested in thinking about how we can learn from developing nations such as Ghana and trying to help, you know, more girls across the globe achieve. So with that background, I'm going to dive right in. So 62 million girls, right? This represents the number of girls across the globe that are school age, but that are still not in school. Yet we know that this is important because educating girls has all of these positive impacts. It reduces infant mortality rates, HIV/AIDS rates, increases economic growth, and empowers women. And certainly, as many of you all know here, there are several initiatives that are developed to increase educational access across the globe. So such as hashtag Sicilian Girls, which is a campaign led by the previous administration's Let Girls Learn initiative, as well as CAMFED and, you know, other international global efforts. But we still don't know very much about how to help girls achieve, right? Especially in academic research. Well, what do I mean by achievement? I take a broad view as not just a measure of academic performance, but also behavior and attitudes towards learning. And this presentation is really focused on the latter part. They're increasingly, and there's a lot of pathways, but increasingly, literature on non-cognitive skills has played an important role in thinking differently about achievement. This essentially represents attributes, attitudes, and personal resources independent of intellectual ability, so such as IQ or ability to learn math, that individuals can draw on to accomplish success. Probably the most famous example is the character trait grit, which is popularized by Angela Duckworth, a psychologist, and that term really represents students' kind of perseverance toward a goal. So these are characteristics or traits, again, that aren't necessarily about learning math, right, but that can be utilized to shape achievement all the same. Academic mindsets represents another kind of non-cognitive skill. These are beliefs, attitudes, and values, ways of perceiving oneself in relationship to their learning environment, and probably the most well-known example of that is growth mindset, made popular by Carol Dweck, which really refers to students' abilities to think about, failure or think about their ability to achieve versus sort of thinking that I'm not a math person, I can't learn math, I can't do better at this. So these are important characteristics or traits because it may be the case that even if people come from backgrounds in which maybe they didn't benefit from early childhood education or have a high level of resources, they can still learn to be gritty, right? And that might still have an important impact of improving their educational outcomes. So does this help us understand how girls achieve? Well, one thing that is clear is that to some extent, non-cognitive skills shape educational achievement. But it's less clear how non-cognitive skills are transmitted, especially as it relates to the role of the school. And this matters because are people just born gritty, or can we actually make people have more grit? And it's even less clear how non-cognitive skills translate in non-Western, non-elite, and among non-male students, because this is where much of the research is done. Yet we know, if we look, for example, at this map that I did not create, but it's based on UNESCO data, where the girls are out of school, we can essentially see that the darkest blue represents the highest concentration of where girls are out of school, and that's in the Sub-Saharan Africa region. In particular, girls in Sub-Saharan Africa are 50% less likely to complete primary school compared to their male counterparts. So it might be the case that if we can think about ways to use or the import of education of non-cognitive skills for achievement, we might be able to fix some of these educational disparities in ways that we see here in the U.S., but there is very little research on countries outside of the U.S. on this topic. So that really informs my research, and this is beginning of trying to think about a larger project that is interested in how non-cognitive skills shape the academic achievement of girls that attend non-elite schools in developing societies. The non-elite part is important because we're really interested in thinking about underprivileged populations and kind of urban city centers, where we think people can probably benefit from these types of interventions the most. What I'm doing today is presenting information that draws on insights from underprivileged girl students, specifically those who are actually striving to be the first in their families to go to college. attending an urban demonstrate how various aspects of the school structure, and by that I mean organizing structure at the leadership level, within the classroom and after school, mediates the effects of their sociocultural environment and individual backgrounds through the facilitation of what I actually call achievement-oriented identities. These identities promote self-belief, and really I mean self-efficacy, and strategy development, thereby enabling girls to navigate the gender-specific challenges that impede on their ability to achieve. Okay, so in the next slide, I kind of just give you the short of what I mean by achievement-oriented identities. These are positive beliefs of one's own ability to succeed and the translation of those beliefs into realizable actions. So the key here and the main difference between maybe growth mindset or grit, for example, is an emphasis not on just kind of self-efficacy, but also on actually preparing students to respond to the challenges that you know may come from their gender status, for example. Evidence of this could be seen through the school context. I'm really interested in how the school might play a role in transmitting these identities. And their intentional actions and activities that occur in a typical day to promote self-belief, and the specific policy actions that support these beliefs. And by policy actions, I mean two things. not just the not just sort of how a school might decide to admit more girls, but also how a school helps girls deal with the challenges that they face directly. So for example, providing sanitary pads to underprivileged girls once a month, right? These are examples of things that help girls address the challenges that are before them. And then I'm interested in thinking about, okay, and how is that reflected in students through these, what I describe as achievement-oriented identities. And we could see this in sort of shifts in their attitudes and behavior toward achievement, particularly in response to educational challenges. So for example, if a student is in a situation where they don't have the money for books, you know, how do students respond to that? How can schools help students respond to these types of issues? In order to explore this, I focus again on the case of Ghana. And Ghana is a compelling case because relative to the countries around it, it's actually had quite progressive girls' educational policies, yet they still have persistent inequalities. So the generation, this specific to completion, is basically at parity at the primary level. The number of boys to girls at the primary school level is almost about the same. But as it goes up to the secondary level, it drops by almost 30%. And this is for a number of reasons, but I'm just gonna highlight three. First, finances. So you have a country where, in general, a majority of the people are dealing with issues related to, you know, economic income. And what this ends up doing is it affects girls especially. So if there's a family of six, and four of them are boys and two of them are girls, families make decisions about who is it worth to invest in. And the idea is that since the girl's gonna get married, that and she will then become a part of another family, it's actually probably a more worthy investment to invest in their boy student. You also have the issue of once they enter the classroom, and at the secondary level in Ghana, you're trapped. So you already kind of do what you would do in college, business, home economics, that type of thing. And you see these home and economic courses, which are still offered in Ghana, are basically 100% girls. And some of those girls may have been great at math or other disciplines that are traditionally associated with males. And this becomes a continued issue because of the bias in which these girls are approached. Then finally, but certainly not least, one of the persistent issues once girls enter the classroom are what one expert calls STGs, sexually transmitted grades. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that because a lot of the teachers are still male, and that is changing, in a sociocultural context where men and women aren't necessarily perceived as equal, this creates a situation in which girl students are maybe asked for favors, right, in exchange for high grades. And this especially matters to girls who think that education might be their only mechanism for improving their lives. So these are just a few of the challenges that girls have to navigate, right? In addition to maybe coming from an impoverished background, these are specific gendered issues that they have to deal with in order to shape their educational achievement. And as I mentioned before, there's not a lot of work in the African context which tells us about how knock-on skills might be able to change that. But there is some promising evidence. So Frimpong's work looks at attitudes towards mathematics, and he finds that more than school quality, as well as individual economic background, confidence played an important role in explaining the achievement levels of girls. And so confidence, again, is not about IQ, it's not about a traditional background, it's really this more soft skill. Similarly, Dolan et al.'s work looks at schools that distribute sanitary pads as well as do puberty education, and they find that the impact of that is that girls' and confidence increase, and they feel more able to engage in the classroom, and it increases attendance rates. So these provide sort of promising evidence of the abilities of confidence, which is a softer skill, to improve achievement. But it's two studies. We still don't really know how this works, and there's not a lot to sort of expand on in terms of how the process of transmitting these skills actually takes place. So for this study, I try to focus on a typical urban school. And when I say typical, this matters because 20% of the schools in Ghana provide 80% of the college students. And so when I was looking for a school in which a typical underprivileged student would probably end up attending, and APSS really fit this profile. This is a pseudonym, you can't look it up. So APSS is a school of about 1,000 students. The gender enrollment ratio was about 60 to 40. Three-fourths of them are low-income at that time, which was defined as about under $2 a day. And they have a WASI passage rate of 55%. That's the equivalent of like an ACT or an SAT here. And the age range is between 15 and 17 years old. And I won't spend a lot of time talking about methods, but I'll talk about some of the political issues that shaped the ability to sort of track students. And so for the methods, this is largely an ethnographic, again, study and investigation of a particular school, but I start by doing a descriptive survey of the school. So I just wanted to know how many hours of housework or homework does a girl at APS do a day, for example, or understand sort of the personal background characteristics in which they come from. After doing the survey, we did a focused investigation of 37 students who we tried to follow over a three-year period. And each time I went to Ghana, I went there for 3 months. And the bulk of the time that I spent was on observations. So we spent 3 to 5 hours a day just looking at their actions and behavior in school, after school, when they went home. And then we tried to follow them a year after they graduated to see sort of where they would end up, especially since many of these girls wanted to go to college but didn't have the objective resources that would suggest that they would be able to make it. And the main thing I was looking for through this data collection was, what are the challenges facing girls at APSS? What does it take for those girls to achieve in this environment? And what ways does the schools contribute to that? So that's sort of the main goal here. In order to analyze this data, I use a model that was really kind of started and shaped, has continued to be shaped through Farrington et al. Out of the University of Chicago Norick Center, and has been actually published in the Department of Education report that tries to think about how students that are operating in this larger sociocultural context, how schools can play an important role in shaping their achievement. And it starts from this premise that background characteristics are shaped what students come into the classroom with, right? So students come into their environment maybe with parents who have low education levels or parents that have low income levels, and that affects their abilities to navigate classes as well as curriculums and everything else. And of course, they're operating within a larger sociocultural context. These are the values that shape a society. And within that school context, of course, they're influenced by the sociocultural context, but the school has an important ability or potential ability to help students mediate the effects of their individual background or the sociocultural context. And I focus on two ways that I think the school at APSS is doing this and that I think are valuable for creating these identities critical for achievement. One is self-belief, but really I'm talking about self-efficacy. So this is actually impressing upon students that not only can that they have the ability to succeed at the challenges that are before them, and the other is focused on strategy, that they can create, implement, and monitor plans that are specific to the challenges in which they face. And together, these contribute to creating positive academic identities where students think that they can learn and they can achieve. And so achievement-oriented identities are basically a type of academic mindset that's focused on self-efficacy as well as strategy. In the words of the students, because these are sort of the two takeaways that I got from what they said, when asked about what it takes to achieve, they essentially stood out the importance of being confident, of having faith, which I'll talk about, of being disciplined, and then they said, and the ability to get things done, which I called strategic, being strategic. And so I looked at areas of the school in which I saw this affirmed or not, and I essentially saw that it was affirmed most at the leadership level, the policies that the schools enacted after school, through the like student organizations, and within the non-academic curriculum. So this wasn't necessarily in classes on math, but actually classes that are quite common in this context, such as life and well-being, or religion and moral education, those kinds of courses, and I'll talk about that in more detail soon. And so first, for the individual background, because I'm using this model to sort of talk through the data, students at APSS, as you can probably gauge at this point, really come from social and economic disadvantage. In the words of the students, I grew up very young, Zongo. You have to work before you survive. People are not going to school. And when they see you alone leaving a uniform in school, they tend to laugh at you. So here in this quote, Zongo actually is equivalent to the word ghetto in the US. And essentially her saying, I grew up very young, right? This kind of idea of survival being important in this space. But also her being in an environment where the students around her aren't necessarily, or the people around her aren't necessarily going to school. And that she herself is not being encouraged. So this already shows you how before a student comes to APSS, this is an environment in which they're coming from, one that already isn't necessarily conducive to learning. And in the words of another student, which is a typical example, I grew up with my mother and father, but my father passed, the money was tight. So I had to come and stay with my aunt. I really wouldn't describe her as a mother. I can't really talk to her like a mother. We don't really have that type of relationship. This quote was important to include because in the Ghanaian context, many people stay with their extended family members. This might be for a number of reasons, but you know, in this particular case, the mother, because she didn't have money, actually lived with another family taking care of them. And so the aunt took on the responsibility. And yet you see that not only is she not coming from a traditional family structure, but that in the family situation in which she's in, she's not necessarily being encouraged. And so these are the backgrounds in which students at APSS are coming into the school setting. And they're operating in this large sociocultural context, again, where men and women aren't necessarily perceived as equal. In the words of Ghana, of one student, in Ghana, they think the office of the lady is the kitchen, right? And this was commonly said. It's almost like a trope of some sort. And this is essentially kind of referring to the ways in which girls feel they're kind of being groomed for being a housewife or for marriage. Similarly, girls reference sort of the unequal burden of the fact that girls can get pregnant and how that shapes their achievement. As one student says, see, he is a guy. He can't get pregnant, but he can impregnate someone, yet still he can move around. But you are a lady. If you should get pregnant before your marriage age in Ghana, it is something else. And even the idea of having a marriage age, I think, is suggestive of the ways in which girls are sort of experiencing differences, right, that are gender-based. And that might seem, you know, obvious, but it's important to sort of point out how these things end up having important effects on girls differently than boys. And then they're operating in a school background or school context that often reflects the students within them. So APSS is in a tough neighborhood, and the words of this is the headmaster, being surrounded by some settlements, the squatters, they pose difficulty for us. They open liquor shops, sell drugs. APSS is more or less a community school. So those who cannot afford a boarding school send their kids to us. I like this quote. It really reminds me of the work that I do in Chicago, for example, where you have urban neighborhood schools in communities that aren't necessarily conducive or best for learning. Here you have a situation where it's essentially a neighborhood school, and it's one in which affordability plays an important role into why the students attend there. In addition, it has a poor reputation, at least in the perception of the students. This is APSS, the most stubborn school in Ghana, the most notorious, the most indisciplined. So it's not the most stubborn school in Ghana, the most notorious, the most indisciplined, but in the eyes of the students, it's not one of the schools that you would so attend if you had a choice to go somewhere else. But outside of that, there's specific gender challenges that really reflect sort of the quotes that the girl said earlier. In the words of one student, ladies drop out because of pregnancies and other things. So here in these first three layers, I'm pretty much just trying to show you that students come from backgrounds of socioeconomic disadvantage. They go to schools that don't have a lot of resources and aren't the best neighborhoods. Then they have the gender challenges on top of that that they're trying to face. So then really, how does APSS help these girls achieve? I'm really interested in thinking about the role in which they play in creating these achievement-oriented identities, which I'm basically using to describe the ability to kind of have self-efficacy, as well as to be strategic in the behavior that you take to respond to your challenges. And I'm just gonna list a few things that they did, and then I'll talk about a few of those examples. So what they did, first they admitted more girls. That was the first step. They posted motivational sayings, which I'll talk about. They affirmed courageous decisions, such as reports of sexual molestation. They actually were okay with that. They created girls' clubs and hosted Sunday talks, which were important for helping girls navigate things like hygiene. I'll just give a quick example. It was expensive, you know, to get things like deodorant. So one thing the senior leadership did was sort of tell girls about alternatives they could use to deodorant, like lemons or other natural things, which became especially important for girls. You also see they emphasize self-discipline rather than punitive measures. They centered faith-based learning, which I'll talk about, and they changed policies that favored boys. Some schools may not realize this, but there's things they've always been doing, right? And those things that they always have been doing actually tend to be biased towards boys. And again, as I mentioned before, I looked at kind of what areas of the institution did I see this really affirmed, and at the policy level, as senior leadership level in terms of policy change, after school, and in the classroom. And so I'm going to use those to really organize the rest of this discussion. Okay, so at the school leadership level, first I'm going to talk about the challenges that was faced, that the school leadership level really helped to address, and how students responded to that. And so first, this is the school when I came, was experiencing their first female headmistress. And the words, in her words, here is a school that had been led by males for the past 60 years, and you come in as a female, like what can she bring to get bear? But I made up my mind I was going to make it. So she's coming into a male environment that's already challenging. But you also see her promise, right? Like, I'm going to make it. She has this attitude. She's sort of used to navigating these types of things. And she's coming to an environment that she observes has timid female students. In her words, now what I noticed about the females in this school, they tend to be a bit timid. I think it has to do with their cultural background. And indeed, that's observed through the students themselves. As a student says, at first I did not believe in myself. From the home, I wasn't being encouraged. And so the headmistress becomes interested in sort of trying to change that. She says, I try to encourage them, make them feel like there's nothing like you being an inferior sex. And I experienced her do that through specific policy changes. One example I'll give is there is an annual speech prize giving day where essentially students get up and sort of give a speech. It's just like an exercise that happens every year. But for the longest time, only a boy would give the keynote speech. That was the idea. And so, in the words of the student, I don't know what happened. Usually it's the boys who gives the speech on the annual prize given day, but this time she said a girl had to do it, and she was the girl that did it. And these are very small things, you know, but they seem to make a big difference. When I asked her what, you know, how did she feel afterwards, she responded, oh, it increased my confidence. I felt like there was nothing I can't do. And in the words of the students, these small actions, like being able to give a speech, has a girl, and that's why it's highlighted in blue, come from saying that I didn't believe in myself and I wasn't being encouraged, which shows you the background that she's coming from, to saying not only that it increased her confidence, but she felt like there was nothing she couldn't do, right? And I think maybe because of the age at which you're in, these small things can actually play a huge role in shaping their perceptions of self. And as the headmistress says a year later, now you can look around and see that the girls are up shoulders with the guys. Yes.
Did the headmistress come in sort of more or less by accident and then make these changes? Or did the school administration beyond the headmistress decide, we want this headmistress?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the way it actually works is it's quite political. When a new administration comes not even a new administration, because she didn't come during an administration, she came towards the end of an old administration, they decide where headmistresses and headmasters go. And so they can go from one school to another school. For example, in the case of this school, she ended up leaving. She really did a great job at the school, and she ended up being switched to another school kind of without her wanting to. So there may be some politics at the government level where maybe people thought she could probably help APSS, you know, reform or something. But she herself doesn't have a lot of agency over those decisions. They basically decide, especially if it's a government school, who goes where. Thanks for that question. This is basically to show the ways in which the school at the leadership level, in terms of specific policy changes, can improve confidence, which plays an important role in developing achievement-oriented identities. We see a similar thing happen after school. There's a lot of research on the importance of after-school programs in a number of ways. One, it helps teach students about discipline, how to balance and navigate the multiple responsibilities that it comes with. In addition, through their peer groups, they develop social support systems, right, that could be very valuable for them. And we see a similar thing happen in the context of APSS, and it becomes important because girls deal with additional issues related to their gender. For example, in the descriptive survey, we found that girls on average reported doing 2 to 5 hours more of housework a day than boys. And so here's an example of a typical schedule, brace yourself. And so she says, okay, I normally wake up around 4 a.m. Yes, 4 a.m. I do my quiet time, sweep the compound, I sweep the living room, take my bath, come to school. After school, I fetch water, then sometimes prepare meals. After that, I go to the shop, and I close around 10. When I come back, there'll be some dishes to wash, study, so I sleep around 11:30 or 12. And after that, I ask her, and you wake up at 4? And she's like, yes. And so this student essentially has about 4 to 5 hours of sleep a day, and this is actually quite common. I just came from Ghana in December, and we're working with another group of girls, And, you know, you basically hear the same thing. And this is just simply not a burden that male students are facing in the same way. And so learning how to be disciplined about one's time and navigate ends up being really important. And so it's something that becomes emphasized at the school culture in a really important way through posters and basically a kind of a campaign. And this mug that the headmistress showed me every single time I went to the school. And so, and they're gendered too. So I won't say that I always encourage, you know, some of the ways in which that was done, but it seemed to be important in this context. And so, as one of the posters says, discipline is the bridge between goals and accomplishments, right? And so the idea is that, you know, push through. That's how you get what you intend to have. Or as this one mug that I mentioned said, act like a lady, think like a man, work like a dog, right? and this becomes important for you hear these kinds of ideas about how to push through despite having a background such as this and related to what girls say. And so, and here's another example of an area in which I'm gonna show how this plays a role, and that's in, you know, getting resources. And so as this one student says, my auntie doesn't give me money to buy books. And so I asked, okay, well then how do you get books to learn? She responds, I save money myself. Let's say I have to board two cars. I'll save money by, if I have to board two, I'll board one and then walk. And this quote is important to show in light of what I was talking about in terms of discipline, because it actually is quite revealing in a number of ways. One, it shows how girls are actually being quite strategic about ways to make up for their individual resource deficits. But it also shows you the level of discipline that's required to, instead of taking something that should have taken two buses, walk instead, when you have schedules that already are quite involved. And so the school becomes important for giving them the confidence and the strategic, you know, ideas about how to respond to the challenges before them. And so when I ask, does she get discouraged, she says, no, I don't get discouraged. If I want something done, I get it done, right? And this really mirrors these kind of really confident attitudes you see in like work like a dog, right? Discipline is the bridge between the accomplishments. This sort of idea that girls should be resilient. Yes, please.
Are you open to conceptual questions, or do you want to get through the presentation and then just questions of clarification?
Clarification.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this plays an important role in kind of shaping the way students think about discipline as well as being strategic. And
I have a clarification question.
Yes.
When she said she goes to the shop, are women there? Are the girls working after school jobs?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. So it's and I mentioned this after school, but by after school I sort of mean things outside of school. And so girls would often like sell bread in the morning. Or help their mothers or families trades, what they call it, so petty trading, where they would basically go and, you know, sell, you know, bananas or something like that. And so she's in a situation where she's living with her aunt, and sometimes what happens, we can talk about this more in Q&A, the extended family members feel like you sort of owe them because they're taking care of you. And so part of her commitment to that relationship is working at her aunt's shop every day after school. And so that is, that's sort of what she's describing in that. So thank you for that question. An interesting thing about Ghana is sort of the importance of religious and moral education. So the background behind formal educational institutions are really linked to Christian missionaries in this context. While these schools today aren't necessarily tied to religion, you know, these are government schools, the practices still very much shape the institution. So they do morning worship, daily prayer, and a lot of the rhetoric surrounding achievement is actually wrapped up in spirituality. So it's just pleasing to God to compare yourself to others, for example. Or if you have faith, right, then you shouldn't be concerned about your ability to pay for school, for example. So I saw this play an important role in shaping two main challenges that girls faced. One was that in terms of boys versus girls. As one student said before, it's a perception that we girls have. We could do something, but we can't be the best. Even if we're going in for it, we can't really match up to the guys, right? And so this is an earlier quote. And what you see are basically things in these religion and moral education courses such as this. Happiness keeps you sweet.
Trials keep you strong. Sorrow keeps you human. Failures keep you humble. Success keeps you glowing, but only God keeps you going, right? And so, as the students are kind of, as you know, given things like this, where even if they don't go to church or identify with religion, they still very much end up becoming indoctrinated with these sort of spiritual-like notions. And what I noticed at the school is they sort of took this and use it as an important way to sort of help girls think about the challenges before them. And so girls responded in the following ways. You have to believe in yourself. You have to know those talents that God has deposited into you, right? And then a year later, this same student, and actually it's not exactly a year, but within a year, because she's still 17, I compete with them and I beat them. And she chuckles because she didn't mean like punch, but she meant performance. I perform better than they do. And so it becomes interesting to think about how girls acknowledge that there's a disparity that exists and how schools are able, through these kinds of courses and rhetoric, to essentially make it seem like, well, comparing yourself or thinking that you can't compete anyway is actually not fair to God, right? We see this happen also in the recurring issue of affordability. These are girls who, or some who want to go to school, or whether it's secondary school or go to college, but actually come from backgrounds that suggest they will not be able to afford it. And so this constantly came up. And so as a student says here, each year I have to pay school fees and someone has to be there to pay. And yet I asked her, you know, how do you think you'll be able to do it? And she says, well, I'm not afraid of that. I don't have fear because I have faith, you know, but you don't have money, you know? And so, but that ends up not being important. And actually, this part is the most fascinating for me because doing work in Chicago and coming from the kind of community that I came from, a number of students actually tend to have an approach that's like, well, I know I don't have the resources. You can't tell me that I'm gonna be able to go to college when I don't have the money. It's sort of like, of course. And so you see this sort of almost, overconfident perception of one's ability because of this belief and this higher sort of order. And again, that shapes faith. And so this is sort of a short way of just showing you how while students come into these environments with certain background characteristics that aren't always valuable for achieving, in a sociocultural context in which patriarchy is a norm and they're not perceived as equal, the school context may play an important role in mediating the effects of that, specifically through encouraging self-belief, and that's through like self-efficacy, as well as strategy, helping girls figure out ways to respond. Take two buses instead of one, or take one bus instead of two. And this shapes positively the academic identities in which they take on, which I call achievement-oriented identities. And as I said in the words of the girls, this is about being confident, embodying being confident, having faith, discipline, and being strategic. And we can see this most in the senior leadership level, after school, and within the curriculum. And of course, I know you're wondering, okay, well, what happens if they graduate and they're faced with real-world challenges? And it's important to say at this point that this is the very early stages and there's a lot more work that should be done around measures and tests and additional cases, and I hope that this could sort of spur that. But I was able to catch up with 12 of the students after they finished school and they were sort of looking to go to college. And four of them ended up going to college, three after a year. One went to the military, four went to teacher training school, and three were sort of in between like work and home. And I interviewed one student, and she's interesting to follow because she was sort of the most confident who got into college but wasn't actually able to afford to go. And I asked about how she felt. And she said, you have some of your colleagues in school, they call you, oh, this and this is happening, and you feel so bad because you haven't been able and you're still not too sure you'll be going to school, and you feel anxious. But thinking worrying won't solve any problem, so you just have to pray to God. And I also applied to scholarships. So I really love this quote, because I think that it's a great way of embodying all of what I'm describing. You see her recognize the challenges before her, describe her feelings of anxiety as a result of them, but also talk about sort of this idea of having faith, but strategically responding to the challenges in which she's experiencing. And I also went back and talked to the headmistress about this girl. And she said, oh yes, I heard about her issue. She said, I told her, here's a brilliant student and a girl as such. I said, you will go to school no matter what. So it seems that these identities even continue to shape her thinking because she knows this girl's come from a background in which typically she wouldn't be able to go to school. She actually did end up going to college, and she just graduated. You know, and it makes it seem like these girls, you know, maybe faith will work out. But it happens through a number of different reasons that I can talk more about, because I also followed a number of girls and their journeys and experiences. So still, again, a lot more work to do, but really what this is meant to highlight is to demonstrate how the school context can really produce these identities that contribute to the academic achievement of its girl learners, and how important it is to account for the gender-specific challenges that girls face, instead of assuming that that's resolved by poverty, which I think a lot of international sort of strategies around achievement disparities do. Ultimately, the sociocultural context needs to be changed, right? So that needs to be changed. Women and men need to be perceived as equal, and that needs to happen. But non-cognitive skills research really helps us to understand how we might be able to mediate the effects of these barriers that come from sociocultural context and individual background to still enable girls to achieve across the globe. So with that, I'll end and just say thank you. Mm-hmm. Am I facilitating? Mm-hmm. Okay.
You awesome. Want to choose, or you want me to choose? Whatever you're.
I'll
let you go ahead.
I don't know anyone's name though. Please. You.
I'm really curious to know. You talked about how the school groomed these girls to have more confidence. Mm-hmm. I wonder if then they took that confidence and sort of went home and negotiated some of the circumstances at home.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to know more about
that. Yeah, that's a really good question, because I did look at, you know, I was able to be a part of the home lives of some of these students, and it varied. So there is one girl who her mother just didn't think that she had the abilities, like the academic capacities, and that persisted for about 2-3 years. And then once she got into a college, the mother sort of shifted her perspective about her, and now is super supportive. She even financially contributes, which she didn't before. So sometimes you can see that actually shift. Other times it's important to mention the academic identity, because they have to navigate that this might be an attitude they have at school, and then that they can't take home. I wanted to write a whole paper about being a schoolgirl, because the idea of wearing uniform, like, you know, walking into a particular environment, I think sometimes can be a bit jarring for certain families in which they're the first, you know, and they want their girl to be, you know, the girl that they know. And so it's important for girls to actually figure out how to sort of remove that, I think, in their home environment to sort of be an obedient child. And so I think it really varies. I'll just go around here, mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you. I was very happy to hear in the story of the young lady who wakes up at 4 that she goes to fetch the water after school.
Yes.
Because as we know very well, in many of these regions, the boys go to school in the morning, the girls spend the morning fetching water.
Yeah.
And never go to school. So is this more prevalent now, the example of this young
lady? Fetching water after school?
Yes, after school.
So honestly, in the rural areas, which this is not focused on, I don't think that has changed very much. In the more urban settings, I think you see people negotiating all of these traditional things about when to do them, you know, and what makes sense. Because these women that are running households in urban areas, they really are, even though these gender inequality issues persist, they're pretty much running households, are more interested in sort of, I think, trying to figure out ways to sort of survival. So if that means fetching water after school instead of before school, it appears to be amenable to that. But I think I can only say that for sort of these more, the inner city sort of areas that I focused on. I think that in the larger scheme of the nation, for example, that people are still taking the same steps, I believe.
I was hoping you could go into more detail about the girls' clubs. I know that was one of the activities that the schools had taken on. So I was wondering if you knew more about like what exactly they do and who they're led by, and how effective you think they are.
Exactly. So I didn't talk a lot about girls' clubs because it came while I was leaving. Before it was just these Sunday talks, it's kind of what I'm calling them, where the headmistress would have people over her house because her home was at the school. In Ghana, they do a very British style. So people walk into these long, you know, the school's on this long lawn, and this headmistress stays on campus. It's kind of like a liberal arts college.
And so that was sort of what happened. And these girls' clubs, I think, have become a more formalized way of doing that. A lot of the work around girls' clubs are actually from sort of development agencies who come, like CAMFED and other places that come into these schools and try to create them. This school actually created the girls' club on their own. So that's pretty interesting. But I can't say sort of the content of what happens there just yet. Because it wasn't a big part of the period that I was there, but it was formed, and I thought it was interesting that it was formed on their, you know, on their own, unless there was some insider development person who was like, you know, deciding to make a student do it at the school. But I think that even the creation of that, you know, could create a social support system, but I can't speak to the content of what happened within them.
Thank you.
Yeah, back
to you. Could you describe the administration a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
I think on one of your slides you said the headmistress came into a very male environment.
Yeah. Yeah, that is typical. And as I said, that's changing, but there's still more male teachers, for example, in the across schools in urban Ghana. And at the leadership level, you know, this is a school that she said before was 60 years old, and she was the only female headmistress. And there were also very few assistant headmistresses. I think there were like two in the school's history. And so, yes, at the administrative level, it was still highly male-led, but there are also more male teachers. But as you saw before, where I said girls were going to teacher training college, it's becoming increasingly popular for girls to now enter training colleges to become teachers, especially because they have a national service where you, a year after school, you have to work for a year for this, like, to give back to the country. And it's supposed to be used as a mechanism to get a job, and teaching is a big part of the kind of jobs, that opportunities that are offered. So it's perceived now as a way of employment. Like, you know that if you're a teacher, you can be employed through the government. And so you see more girls doing that now. For a long time and during this period, and still, men, I think, represented the bulk of the administrative roles as well as the teaching roles in the country.
So then, is this particular, the administration of this particular school, are they special in that they're doing all these things and paying such attention to initiatives to promote achievement for girls?
Yeah, so.
Are they special or?
Yeah, so they are in that they have a headmistress that's a woman in an environment in which most schools don't have that. And so she is intentional about what to do about that. And that's why it's a school I'm actually interested in focusing on. Because it benefits from this sort of accidental intervention. So that's sort of the short answer. And I think, you know, can more schools that don't have senior leadership do things like admit more girls or, or, you know, help girls sort of think through, you know, hygiene? I think yes. And so I think these are things that other schools could do. But the reason why I focus on it is because you actually see, I get to come there at a time where a new group comes, right? And it's trying to make these changes. So I can actually see how it impacts the attitudes of these girls. Okay.
This is just a follow-up.
Yeah, okay, sure.
This is a follow-up on that, which is, if in your story, a great deal of this change depends on a single change agent.
Yeah.
Namely, this particular
mm-hmm.
headmistress.
Mm-hmm.
Who accidentally came into this
mm-hmm.
job. It wasn't that she was picked because the school decided.
Exactly.
And then she accidentally left.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to compare the school while she was in to the school before and the school after in
mm-hmm.
the way of girls going to college or whatever it might be. But the problem is that if you're trying to generalize it
mm-hmm.
to sort of broader, you know, how do we create more change? It looks as if we have to create more of those headmistresses.
Yeah,
and who was very intentional, as I said.
Exactly.
She put the girl in a speaker. She gave the girls these pep talks.
Mm-hmm.
She met with the girls at her house on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things are very clear change-oriented
exactly.
actions.
Exactly.
And so you would need not only a descriptive person, not only a female headmistress, you'd have to have someone who saw herself as an explicit change agent in regard to all this.
Yeah,
and so I wonder whether
mm-hmm.
one way of trying to produce more headmistresses like that would be to have a kind of, have some donors have a sort of program for women who are thinking of going into teaching, and kind of indoctrinate them in the possibility they could be change agents like this woman. I'm only thinking, how do we take this to scale? Because it's just one person.
I think you're right, and I think there's a lot of things in the U.S. that suggest that people actually think that if we can train teachers, or if we could train educators to be like change agent principals, they can go to a school and reform them, you know. And I'm not yet sure that that's sort of what it takes. So I'm not at the point where I would say that. But I will say that once she left, the assistant headmaster became the headmaster. And I still work with that school in a lot of different, various other capacities. And you see, as I said, things like the Girls Club and other things pop up that are equally as progressive, and he's just himself way more conducive to working on girls' issues than before. So maybe it's not always necessarily about, maybe he benefited from being under her leadership, but now he can take on a lot of those things as well. So I don't know yet that we need to have change agent individuals in every school. We just need to have ways to expose, I think, senior leadership to sort of the benefits of these things. And he got his exposure through this headmistress, and he's able to continue those things even after she leaves. And so, but it's something to think more about, and you know, I definitely hear what you're saying.
Could I add just two things? Sorry, I'm gonna mimic you. But just going back, actually we had an earlier presenter in the seminar, not this year, but last year, on the stereotype inoculation model, mm-hmm. which might be something to look at. The woman's name is Das Gupta. She's I'll send you the information.
Okay.
She's faculty, I think, at UMass Boston. But she's done this wonderful work looking in the United States at girls in STEM, but
mm-hmm.
showing very powerful effects of having women teaching science courses.
Mm-hmm.
And so this could be an analogy also to your earlier points
yeah.
about getting more women in faculty and faculty administration.
Right,
positions.
Right. Thank you for that.
If I could just pop into the STEM part of this too.
I'm not against this.
I was thinking about the bridge between formal learning and informal learning,
mm-hmm.
and that I think is where we particularly see work that's being done in STEM, of trying to make sure that what goes on in school and what's going on in these STEM enrichment programs
right.
have some kind of resonance with one another.
Right. It's a very, very important point, because that class, this sort of non-academic class, seems to be doing important work, and that's probably that bridge, or part of that bridge that you're describing. Okay. Here.
Having the headmistress, did you see a decline in the STG?
Oh, yes, I'm glad you brought that up. I had a slide, you're always deciding on what to include or not to include. So before, it appears that, like Ghana, this school, like a lot of other schools, even here in the U.S., that there was a culture or a taboo around going against male leadership. These girls want to graduate. And so what actually happened during the time that I was doing this study is one of a student reported that she was being sexually molested to another student. And that student decided to actually go and report that to the administration with a group of other people, including boy students. So that's
mm-hmm.
important to mention. The senior leadership was actually receptive to that. And while the senior leadership didn't talk to me about it, I did observe the teacher get asked to leave. And what we saw is that students then felt like they could report these incidents at higher rates. But I imagine that, it really just depends on when they report how that's received. Right, and I think that's playing a huge role why you don't hear it as much in other, or even the girls not thinking that they can say something, I think plays an important role. And a lot of girls still don't think they can. So it really relies on the courageous sort of actions of one or two girls who think that they, are willing to sort of put themselves out there. And I found in this case that the girls who came from these really underprivileged backgrounds who felt like, I have to survive, I have nothing to lose, actually end up being great people for taking on these kinds of leadership roles, because they're not really afraid.
of their rebuke as much as, you know, maybe other students. So I think that's another discussion about ways in which we could actually use sort of people's environments to actually find other awesome characteristics and qualities that could help create larger cultural changes here.
Yeah. So first of all, I really want to thank you because I think your work is extraordinary. But I also wanted to share something about the faith
mm-hmm.
aspect
oh, yeah.
of this.
Yeah.
So the most remarkable woman that I know is from Tanzania, and she grew up barefoot in the bush. That's her description of her childhood. And she became the director of civil aviation in Tanzania. So, you know, she's a really extraordinary person. And, you know, she was my classmate when I did an MBA at Simmons. And she was like a role model, I think, for the whole class. She was really
mm-hmm.
exceptional. And, you know, one of the things I noticed, or one of the things she told me, was that when she went into a challenging situation, the way she used her faith, and she was Catholic, you know, I think probably very
oh, yeah.
similar to many of the girls that you met, would be, she'd say, "Okay, God, don't let me down." And so, you know, this was for her like a personal support. And, you know, and she knew that it was kind of available to her
mm-hmm.
in all these different situations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because, I mean, how else do you kind of string that life together and kind of explain how she did it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a, you know, that plus a million other things. But
mm-hmm.
so not too long ago, I went to a travel show, right? And there was a come to Tanzania, right? You know, so I asked the guy who was kind of selling Tanzania, I said, "Do you know Margaret Mnangagwa, right?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "well, I don't know her, but I know her by reputation. She's tough." So anyway, so you know, I think that's just an example of the kind of I don't know, extraordinary kind of potential that I think there is. And you know, that's one of the reasons why I think your work is so, you know, important. But also in the U.S., you know, I think I'm so glad you made that parallel with your work in Chicago. So anyway, that's it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think faith-based, you know, learning or is interesting. I think even if it's not religion, it shows you the importance of helping students think of ways to be encouraged through sort of other mechanisms. Now they're starting to do things where they like have meditation in schools or, you know, and I think all of those are examples of how people are trying to find ways to help people sort of deal and respond to stress and trauma. And I think that's what faith is sort of doing in this context. Okay, sure. I wasn't sure who was next.
Mm-hmm.
You're next.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that I think one of the things you highlight so beautifully is a way in which all the problem solving that goes on in under-resourced communities involves executive function skills that we tend not to recognize as such. So I think that emphasis on strategy and on recognizing that everyday problem solving is kind of elevated in their own minds as well as recognized from the outside for the asset it is really, really crucial. And I think that's relevant to how we think about, you know, when we look at the demands that people who are recipients of public assistance and all the work it takes to navigate those systems, it's rare that we recognize it as an executive function level set of skills.
Yeah.
And I think your work is
wow,
framing
that
it in that
really
way.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Sorry.
I was just curious if there was resistance to like, sort of the changes that were happening and what that looked like and how it was dealt with.
Yeah, that's a great question, yes. And sometimes when I present my work too. So Ghana is, you know, changing, and that's great. You know, the Speaker of Parliament was a woman, you know, Attorney General. They had a, you know, vice presidential candidate. You know, so it's really in this, you know, great place. And so they've also have been a recipient of every Educate the Girl Child campaign
mm-hmm.
that there is. So there's like songs, you know, and that kind of thing. And so, you know, some of the women and men be like, you know, "I'm tired, you know, of hearing about this,
issue. Like, there's poor boys, and there is. Mm-hmm. And I really try to even think about in this sort of idea of achievement-oriented identity, I don't gender the definition itself. I just say that it's actually amenable to gender challenges. Because I think that, and I did see, that you would hear also guys say, who were from impoverished backgrounds, say things like, you know, faith, you know, will get me through, or whatever the case is. So there is an element of, like, you know, and you see that here too, as gender gaps shift, of resistance to this idea that things should be specialized for girls. And that's why I tried to spend a lot of this talk, and even when I'm in this setting, just talking about, well, there's other elements that are specific to gender that are still, we have to account for. But yes, there was definitely resistance in terms of, in relationship to being like, these are things that seem to be benefiting girls, or some of these policies actually seem to be benefiting girls, and sort of, why is that necessary? This is a poor school, right? Like, there's a lot of issues that the school itself is sort of dealing with. So, I wasn't doing anything. I was just writing it down, so it wasn't to me.
Right.
Yes.
So, going back to this idea of, like, how do you generalize and
yes.
learn from it,
mm-hmm.
and I love this idea of South-North transfer of learning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about selection effects.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they must be so acute, as you're pointing out,
mm-hmm.
for boys, but then even more for girls,
mm-hmm.
right? And probably selecting on some of those things that you're studying, right?
Mm-hmm.
It must take just extraordinary grit, as you describe in your quote,
mm-hmm.
just to walk through the community in that uniform day after day,
mm-hmm.
and because you're signaling a lot of things when you're doing that, you know. So I wonder, you know, how you think about that? Like, how do you apply this? How could, you know, how have you thought about how this would extend to a context like in Chicago, where
mm-hmm.
just, you know, just a greater proportion of the disadvantaged children are going to have access to school. But there aren't those harsh selection mechanisms. So you're going to also have kids who maybe don't, for whatever reason, have quite the same level of grit to start.
Yeah. So secondary schools in Ghana are free. So they're accessible. There's fees that you have to pay. But they're accessible, and obviously through this project, I can't tell if like these girls were sort of gritty already. I just know how they talked about their confidence before, and then how they spoke about it sort of after these changes. For example, I think in the context of the U.S. or Chicago, that there's actually a lot that could be sort of similarities. You know, these are students that are coming from backgrounds that are very challenging. They themselves. Live in communities that are challenging, and these schools, you know, reflect that. And I think, so what does it look like for students in Chicago to end up, you know, achieving? And I think the answer is kind of similar. They need to sort of first kind of have self-efficacy. They need to actually believe that they'll be able to succeed, instead of having this idea that I definitely grew up with, which is sort of like, come on, like, I know I don't have the resources this next person has. Like, you can't tell me I can't. They come in, I think, sometimes with that perception. And so first we have to think about how do we sort of think through that. And then the other part is sort of, okay, they're dealing with challenges every single day they walk out of the house. How do they navigate that? And so what can the school do? And there's some, you know, cool examples, I think, of what people are doing. You know, like the YES program that's focused on males in Chicago, which is actually addresses directly. The problem is they're not in school. They're like these sort of external after-school programs. But if we could bring those, like you said, formal and informal programs into schools that actually help them be like, okay, what are you dealing with? You know, and how can we help you respond to those things? You don't have enough money for books? You know, we don't either. But maybe we can, you know, figure out a way. Like, do you take 2 buses a day? Like, you know, that type of thing. And so I think that the import of what needs to be done to help disadvantaged students achieve in terms of self-efficacy and strategy are actually similar. How we do that, you know, at the school level is what I'm really interested in doing. And instead of there being kind of a number of small initiatives that do it in some ways, in different capacities, how do you institutionalize that? And what I really liked about what Kim said is about thinking about the everyday
executive functions that are required, and how maybe through a bridge between formal and informal kind of classes, you can actually help students take those things they probably already have, and some to some extent, but actually mold that so that it actually fits something that's conducive to academic achievement. So that's the beginning of thinking about that. But you know, I definitely hear what you're saying in terms of pushing to think about these selection effects, and I hope that as this sort of, as I think more about specific measures, that through larger studies we can sort of better refine these things and be able to address those questions directly. So if you have, because I know you had one too. She's first.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm just curious, we're working with kids that work from 15 to 18.
Yes.
So if you're 18, when this headmistress comes, you're being like treated by this negative school effect for a longer period of time.
Yes.
15. So I'm really curious, did you see like a stronger effect on the 15-year-old? Do you notice anything?
Yeah, so actually what I probably should have done is, when I say 15 to 18, I started with girls who were in their third year, followed them the next year, and then after they finished school. So I didn't really look at different cohorts, which would have done the job that you're basically asking about. Certainly there was variation in age within.
Yeah.
But that's difficult to, that's easy.
Because they've been there the same amount of time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's that problem. And the other issue is, that there's a lot of overage in I think they call that, I'm not sure that's the right term, but basically girls might go to school later, so they could be in their second year and be 18. And that could still be interesting, for example, but I can't speak to it. Yeah. And you had a question too?
Yeah, so I guess two questions that I realize you may not have an answer for. So I'm wondering, you talked a lot about what happened to the girls. I'm wondering if some of this stuff spilled over to
the boys.
To the boys too.
I did talk to the boys too.
Uh-huh.
And they would say things like, I didn't find a lot of the interviews or the way I asked to be helpful in terms of like giving you, you know, answers that I can say have a lot of import. But as students would say things like, you know, yeah, now I clean up a lot too, you know, or you know, or you know, they would sort of talk about you know, some of their own challenges and how they realize the value of sort of gender equality. But I don't think that boys in Ghana sort of had very negative perceptions about gender, for example, to begin with. They just sort of operate in the context, like they go along with it. and I think a lot of those things start to be cemented when people get married or when they sort of become formal adults in this economy, and they see how sort of, you know, how to get a job and how to, you know, people end up doing it a lot later, I think. So in terms of the conversations that I have with boys, around their achievements, I said, I saw them reference similar things around faith, for example. I saw a lot of similarities, but they just, you know, they weren't doing as much housework or homework. They would describe doing more housework, but that had nothing to do with what the school was doing. this wasn't a boarding school. And outside of that, they would say, yeah, I think girls should be, you know, they had positive attitudes when asked. I don't know if that's how, you know, observing it looked, you know, there were gendered parts, but I don't think there was any more gender than what you would see probably in a U.S. school, you know, where maybe the boy asks the girl for her number, like, you know, those kinds of things.
Well,
so,
you know,
on
the idea of, you know, academic mindset, I mean, so, you know, some of the techniques the headmistress was doing were, I mean, the mud was terribly interesting, right?
Yeah.
And so I wonder, well, so, you know, if a boy saw that,
what
I don't know how they would receive some of these things. I mean, did it, like, you know, could there be some adverse effects?
Doing
some of these strategies like a zero-sum game?
I guess that's if it's perceived as a zero-sum game. Because it's kind of a compliment to a guy, right? Like, act like a lady, think like a man, you know? And so, so I'm not sure that they're threatened by things like that. I think what you'll really notice is, you know, maybe if the girl keeps giving the speech on Speech and Prize Given Day, you know, or if, you know, if she becomes, you know, the school president, right? I think once you start to see, same thing like in the U.S., women take over, so to speak, these spaces that were traditionally male in a substantive way, then I think you'll start to witness the threat. I don't think the boys saw themselves as threatened yet.
And I think, though, because, and Ghana had another period where it slumped down again, so I can't say that they're on a persistent up and up. The economy really shapes how girls are affected. We know this in important ways. But if they continue on an upward path, I think future iterations of this research might find something different. But I didn't get the impression from the conversation I had with guys that they felt threatened. It was sort of like, yeah, girls should be equal, you know. Even my mom's starting to make me do more housework, you know, things like that, I think were more common. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves as women take on, you know, higher forms of leadership at the school level as well as in the nation. Yes.
So I was just thinking about your model of the interaction of confidence and then strategy, and thinking about strategy as an executive function. Mm-hmm. And I was, I don't know why, but it took me to Todd Rogers' research on making a plan to vote. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if within some of these sessions there could be an explicit plan about how to get to the end goal, whether that's graduation or college, mm-hmm. how girls could think about navigating the many challenges in a more effective way to get to the end point.
Yeah, I guess
almost like
career planning.
And then also, would it remind them that they have so many obstacles? Could it backfire in a way if they made that plan? Because in comparison, they are reminded of the obstacles. I don't know, it's just...
That's interesting, to think about if they could sort of formally plan it. I think it's hard for institutions to sort of individual, especially with lack of resources, to individualize plans for students. And I think that's why it's always hard to do this work when you have so many students coming from backgrounds where there's a number of different issues. I think what's interesting to me in terms of why understanding the things, gender challenges, because there's some things that girls in this particular social culture context are gonna experience. They're gonna, you know, have a menstrual cycle. You know, if they're going to deal with more housework and homework in this environment. And so maybe a way to do that is to think about these sort of more general issues. I'm just thinking about, because of the difficulty of individualizing what's happening in these contexts, but perhaps these courses could be used to do individualized planning, like they try to do career planning or going to college planning at some institutions. But we know that when resources are short, the first thing to go is sort of these kinds of exercises. So I think that's where the self-advocacy part comes into play. You know, they may not have that at their disposal, and we kind of have to figure out ways for students themselves to just be problem solvers, first and foremost. And then hopefully when they're faced with these different challenges, they can apply that to these various things. Because they can't predict. That's another thing. I don't think a lot of students can't predict what they're going to go through each and every day, given the environments in which they come from. So. But that's a potential way of thinking about it. I definitely want to think about it more. Yes?
I was just curious, since you talked about the school admitting more girls, I was curious how the admission works, and if it's competitive, and if it's a matter of the school needing to recruit more girls, or if they're actually denying admission.
That's a good question. So this isn't a competitive school. It's very much a neighborhood school. And so 80% of students live within a 10 to 15 mile radius of the institution. And so in terms of admitting more girls, they benefited because most of the schools were admitting more students anyway, in general, in addition to colleges. This had to do with actually, you see here in the US too, like, you know, you get funding based on you know, students, the number of students that come there, especially because they're charging these small fees. And so they needed more resources. So they were admitting more students. But as they were admitting more students, sort of the decision was like, you know, well, we have 70, at the time it was 70% to 30% girls. And so the idea was like, well, if we're admitting more students in the neighborhood, we should focus on girls. The senior administration wanted to focus on girls. But I didn't get the impression that it was very scientific. But I don't know, because that's not, I wasn't privy to the whole process.
I was interested about the fees point, because I lived in Ghana for a bit, and my understanding was that secondary education, although it was like a bill was passed to make it free, it never was implemented. And then Mohammed said he didn't implement it. I left before then, but I thought it hadn't gone ahead. So it's really interesting that you were saying that the costs were mainly associated with like school supplies, not with the cost of school. And I'm wondering if that means that the school must be like somehow being funded by someone else, and that not aware of it, but just the implication of the fact that if this is a free school, it's one of the first free secondary schools, and what does that mean for when that's universally implemented, if it hopefully is, about actually, you know, the cost is not a barrier, there are.
Exactly. So, no, so government subsidized schools, you know, there was the Education for All Act passed in Ghana in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that, and Ghana's had different iterations. It was kind of a pioneer after colonization in the 60s of free education. And they've had different rounds of that because, you know, they say these things and it's like, how do you fund it? And so they, you know, they had the Education for All, and schools were free, but they couldn't really afford for them to be free, so then they cost, and then they did small things at the national level to make the cost of uniforms free, to make the cost of, I think they even tried, like, you know, school supplies. But what happens is, and this happened to the schools that I focus on, is sometimes they just don't give the schools the money. So the schools have to create fees anyway. And even when the schools do get the money, those fees sort of stay intact. And these fees are for, like, you know, they say for feeding, for school supplies. They say they're for these sort of non-tuition-based activities. But I get the impression that they really help the schools operate, especially when they're dealing with a situation where at the national level, the reliability of that funding isn't always there. I could talk a lot about how the rhetoric around free education is realized for schools that are supposed to sort of be recipients of that. It tends to be very unpredictable, but nonetheless, they are subsidized by the government, and eventually they will get funding somewhere, some form. But what schools do while waiting on that, or in the meantime, are they create these sort of small fee-based systems that are supposed to be for school supplies or other activities that end up kind of being an important part of how they operate. Yeah, so this isn't a special school that had free. It was one of the schools that are a part of a larger system.
Wonderful.
Okay, awesome. Thank you guys. Thank you guys.
Really brilliant, wonderful, far-ranging implications. I hope you all can join us next week. We have Professor Paul von Hippel from the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's going to present a careful analysis of income inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope you join us then. Mm-hmm.